Hi, I'm Kit O'Connell.
And I'm Risa Brown. Hopefully you could have figured that out.
Howard Waldrop is the former Vice President of Science Fiction Writers of America. During the election season, he posted to the Science Fiction Writers of America Live Journal about why he wouldn't be running again. And a lot of it was, as far as we could tell, his fear of the internet. And as you can see, he says, I think the ongoing and increasing sublimation of the private space of consciousness into public net space is profoundly pernicious. For that reason, I don't much like to blog, wiki, chat, post, Live Journal, or lounge in sff.net. A problem with the whole wiki-clicky, sycophancy, jerk-de-circle of a networking and connection-based order is that if you go along to get along for too long, there's a danger you'll no longer remember how to go it alone when the ethics of the situation demand it. Next slide. He goes on to say, I'm also opposed to the increasing presence in our organization of web scabs who post their creations on the net for free. A scab is someone who works for less than union wages or on non-union terms. More broadly, a scab is someone who feathers his own nest and advances his own career by undercutting the efforts of his fellow workers to gain better pay and working conditions for all. Web scabs claim they're just posting their books for free in an attempt to market and publicize them. But to my mind, they're undercutting those of us who aren't giving it away for free and are trying to get publishers to pay a better wage for our hard work. And now we go on here.
I disagree with Mr. Waldrop. We found a dueling quote, this one from Cory Doctorow. But there's another reason that these new media tell stories in different ways from their old media predecessors. They're telling different stories. TV sitcoms, novels, feature films, and other traditional forms are cages as well as frames. The reason that every sitcom lasts 22 minutes is that no one tries to make sitcoms about stories that take 5 minutes to tell. The reason movies last 90 minutes is no one tries to make feature films about subjects that take 30 seconds to elucidate or 30 days. The critics of new media often point to its failure to live up to the standards of old media. Some scientists and science journalists wring their hands at the idea that the Mars landers and the Large Hadron Collider emanate information in the form of anthropomorphized Twitter messages, arguing that these messages lack the formal virtues of science reporting and papers. It's true, they do. They don't succeed at being better in-depth science articles than the science articles. They succeed at being better Twitter messages than the science articles. They succeed at producing and sustaining a different kind of interest and understanding than a long article in the weekend paper. The low cost of deploying new media online is revealing a heretofore unsuspected appetite for stories in different boxes than we've heretofore used, and a universe of stories waiting to be told. From a recent article by Cory Doctorow published on the net. And that is much more the focus of the rest of this presentation. Basically, this paper and the projects that resulted along with it are the result of about 9 months of intense brain work and lots of discussion. And how it all started was from me ranting one day about Mr. Waldrop and bemoaning the fact that people in charge of major science fiction organizations are so technophobic. And I really wanted to see, instead of every new technological invention being the death of the novel, I would rather much see it as what can we do with this to enhance the storytelling experience for people? How can we use this technology to push it forward? And so that's kind of, once I started thinking about that, I started trying to bounce those ideas off other people, and it took off a bit.
Within 200 years of, we're going to be on this slide for a little while, so within 200 years of Gutenberg inventing his printing press, erotica was being published using movable type. Pornography has consistently driven technology since the beginning, and writing and sex have been, you know, intimately linked since the novel began. Pretty much wherever you peg the beginning of the novel, you can find sex there, whether it's the early Japanese examples of the form, the Decameron, Canterbury Tales. The novel started in porny stuff. And we've seen that, of course, all throughout the development of technology. Anytime there's a new way to communicate ideas and emotions and and all kinds of crazy academic stuff like that. People start using it for sex. And, you know, we can see that now in the development on the internet of erotica sites like literotica.com, and which, you know, is, for those who haven't visited it, are the site for posting people's erotic stories. We've seen, you know, printing presses, presses dedicated now to science fiction erotica, such as Cecilia Tan's Circlet Press. And further than that, M. Christian, the erotic writer, actually believes that the boundaries between erotica and other genres are vanishing as we get further and further into this century. You can see mainstream presses starting to publish erotic novels because they've realized that they're a driving force for sales. And of course, the rise of the supernatural romance genre is another example of the linking of science fiction and sex in the popular imagination. And for those who haven't encountered one of these books, they usually involve, you know, hot manly werewolves and the women who love them.
Don't forget the vampires.
Yeah, vampires too. Hot manly werewolves and the vampires who love them sometimes. One of the most recent interesting examples I've seen of that dropping of barriers between erotica and other genres is that Tor Books, I have a copy with me if anyone wants to take a look. Tor Books recently published, Tor being one of the largest science fiction publishers, a collection called Deep Inside by Polly Frost, which are a collection of really raunchy erotic fantasies. And yes, they're genre-based, but this is not, you know, aliens and spaceships with an incidental sex scene. This is sex with incidental spaceships. And I think it really, that was a perfect example to me of how it's becoming more mainstream to the extent that science fiction is mainstream. And despite the sort of Luddites that we've seen in science fiction, as Howard Waldrop makes an excellent example of that, there's also been a really powerful movement against that in science fiction. In response to his statement about people being pixel-stained techno-peasants, which was part of that same wiki-clicky rant that we saw earlier, they declared International Pixel-Stained Techno-Peasant Day, which gave away lots of free fiction. Also, you can visit sites like Futurismic, which I think is one of the links I've got on there. If you want to switch to the links, I think rather than actually having him click on this, I'm just going to point out that I can give people the address, and we'll put it up later, that I have a Delicious Links under the name Todd Fox, where I'm putting up all the links of the various things that I've described in this. So I think rather than waiting for each of them to load, I'm just going to point up to them here. But if you check this out, I can give people the URL later, or we'll post them on one of the websites that we're going to give at the end of the PowerPoint, and you can check out all the links that we discuss here. Yeah, delicious.com/ToddFox. And then the tag it's under is AE2. But it's also really the most recent 20 or so links because I collected those today. So, all right, go ahead and switch back to the PowerPoint. Anyway, you know, despite the Luddites in science fiction, there's a lot of sources on the internet to receive free fiction, and it's been really successful for a lot of people. Not only that, some people are starting to explore using the internet itself to help storytelling, to create fiction and story, and to share it with the world. But right now, it's a little bit like the first days of television, where most TV shows were radio shows with cameras aimed at them. This is what we're seeing now is mostly old media being transported onto the internet, rather than using the internet to create actual forms of new media. But we're about to describe a number of exceptions to that, of different projects which have tried to use the internet as a new tool for storytelling.
Okay, I guess I'll just start off on this one. What Kit was just talking about is a little bit, you know, brief overview of some of the history of what got us to where we are right now. And a lot of what's going on right now is a lot of people just testing the waters, experimenting, you know, trying a bunch of different models and seeing what works and what doesn't. One of the early stages, and there's plenty of more examples that if, you know, you want to grab us into a corner at some point during the weekend and talk our ear off, we can come up with several different examples that we didn't include in the presentation for purposes of time. But one of the early examples of someone trying to go from a traditional print publication towards using the internet to profit and share creativity was actually Stephen King. There was a pair of books called Riding the Bullet and The Plant that he originally released Riding the Bullet for free online. But in order to get The Plant up, readers had to pay, like reach a certain amount of payment for each chapter installment. And this didn't actually succeed. I think they got about 75% of the way through the second book and didn't get enough donations. And so he quit. He didn't ever finish posting the rest of it. And one of the reasons that we think that this failed is it was very much set up on the guilt the reader into pain sort of model, at least as far as how we interpret it. You end up feeling like, as a consumer, that you're paying for the same story over and over and over again, because basically all you're getting is another chapter in the book. And from a business perspective, if you're going to be asking the customer to pay over and over again, you need to be each time giving them something that they feel is adding value to the purchase for them to want to keep doing it. So this early model, you know, that's one of the reasons that we think that that one kind of dropped off. But it kind of led into other things. I don't know if everybody, you know, derived from it directly, but some people got the idea that that wasn't necessarily the best approach, and so started coming up with more customer-friendly ideas.
There's, of course, many examples now of people giving away free fiction. As I said before, the blog Futurismic every Friday does a roundup of a lot of the free science fiction that you can find on the internet that people are managing to make money from despite being web scabs. One example that's not giving it away for free, but still, I think, related to this, Jim Bain's Universe, the publisher Bain, has a number of interesting offerings. One, of course, is the Bain Free Library, which is a collection of, it may be up to hundreds or even thousands of novels at this point, I'm not sure, from their library. And that's not only been given away for free online, but sometimes you'll buy one of their hardcovers and it'll actually have a CD slipped into it with all these books on it. Of course, many of them are the first book of a series, which then gets you hooked, and you go out and buy the rest of them. And similarly, Tor.com has recently started putting up a lot of their books for free. Of course, one of the real pioneers of this was Cory Doctorow, who we quoted at the beginning. And he started almost from the beginning of his career putting up his novels online for free. Usually under a Creative Commons license, especially recently he's been putting them up under Creative Commons licenses that specifically allow non-commercial remixing or derivative work, which allows for fan fiction, although not commercially viable fan fiction. But it does, you know, explicitly say you can take this and do fun, artistic, creative things with it, and no lawyer is going to come knocking on your door unless you try to make money from it. And I think this shows that a valid profit model on the internet can sometimes be finding ways to give things away for free and yet encourage people to pay for them anyway. When people pick up one of Cory Doctorow's books online, of course, if they, you know, they may read it all themselves, but then they're going to recommend it to their friends or pass it on to their friends and buy it for them, and of course he ends up profiting.
One of the other things that we discovered when we were looking around were, you know, obviously we knew about them already, podcasts, but in specifically how this could be applied towards literary, or not even just literary, but storytelling applications. Things like Escape Pod, Pseudopod, and Podcastle are all purchasing science fiction and fantasy stories, and I think horror as well, right? Mm-hmm. And redoing them as audio files and putting them up for free for people to download. And this, again, is reaching a different market, you know, someone who can't necessarily interact or access your stories in a visual sense, or, you know, whether or not it's physical ability or just place. You know, if you're in your car, it's not necessarily quite as smart to be watching TV. So you can still have stories, and obviously, you know, this goes back again to the radio show days. You know, people are doing the equivalent of taking the old-time radio shows to the internet. Things like Metamore City and other radio show-style productions. All of them are based on giving away free content. Most of them seem to make money through donations or selling CDs and merchandise. This kind of introduces what we're going to be touching on a little bit later, in that
one of the things that we think of in 21st century storytelling, or one of the things that we discovered in our research, is that it's not going to be a single sense medium for most purposes. It's not going to be just something you read or just something you listen to. It's more likely going to have aspects of many different sensory interactions. And this kind of also extends, you know, the podcast example also shows one of the other things that we discovered when we were talking to some of our business consultants and doing this research is the finding the niche market. There's a model out there called 1,000 True Fans, and I don't necessarily, I've read it as 500 True Fans. The number changes depending on the article that you read. But basically, if you were able to get in touch with the true fans, the ones that are the direct recipients that are hungry, starving for your story that you have to put out there, and these people were to give you $100 a year in purchasing CDs and merchandise and other things to support your creativity. And if you had 1,000 of those, well, then you have $100,000 a year. It's not necessarily that simple, of course, but a lot of groups have started to capitalize on that, and I think we'll see more of that kind of thing, people trying to find various ways to getting to the people that really want to hear what they have to say, and then finding ways to profit off of that.
This is as good a place as any to add that another thing that we found out is that people seem to be really hungry for stories. If you look around on the internet, people will grab hold of almost any interesting hook that allows them to tell stories or to hear stories or to experience stories. And that's something that comes up all over the place. One of the examples that we found was a video series called Lonely Girl 15, which was very popular with a certain set. And it began as a series of video blogs by, you know, a seemingly normal girl, teenage girl, writing about her life that over time started to become stranger and stranger. People went to some extreme lengths to discover that it actually was a video that had been scripted by writers with an actress as the teenage girl, and it ended up being this extended story of mysterious cults and you know, nasty things like that. In fact, one of the most interesting things that they did was that their first story arc had a finale which took place in real time over a day, with videos released every hour and each of them taking place during that time of day. So that it sort of added, one of the examples of refers back to our quote at the beginning, filling different spaces for story that wouldn't be possible in other mediums. Another interesting thing that happened is that fans started creating their own videos, and some of those were integrated into canon and became actual parts of the storyline and ended up influencing where the story went. And this shows that online media blurs the lines between what we call canon and fanon, which are, you know, fan-created works that are, you know, tell part of the story but aren't accepted by the world's creators. In, you know, a lot of the online media, we're starting to see people actually accepting the existence of fanfic as part of the actual quote-unquote storyline, as opposed to just the storyline that unfolds in the fans' heads.
And that's definitely one of the areas that there's a big division in, as if anybody keeping up with recent media knows that J.K. Rowling joined the ranks of people who are, you know, suing fans for creating derivative works and then attempting to make money off of them. And, you know, there's very much a big divide in among science fiction and fantasy, and probably to some extent to the larger literary community, between whether or not you retain copyright, whether or not you take, you know, a more digital rights management approach to your stories, or whether or not you go the doctoral route and, you know, open them up to everyone and just trust that you will make money because people are willing to. In a lot of situations, one of the business models that keeps coming up again in online business projects is that if you give it away for free, they will pay for it. I think we mentioned that earlier, and this is another area that kind of touches on.
In the last few years, alternate reality gaming is another example of new form storytelling that we're starting to see on the internet. So far, all of the successful alternate reality games, with possibly one or two exceptions, have been basically advertisements, viral advertisements, where at the end of the storyline, you know, it's revealed that they want you to go see artificial intelligence, you know, AI, in the movie theaters, or go play Halo 2. And the people that play these are aware of this. It's not like they're suddenly shocked at the end to find out that it was actually a commercial enterprise that they're involved with. But what they are getting involved with are these games that definitely blur the lines between the fiction and reality, because the players will reveal the story over time by finding puzzles and solving them themselves. They may call phone numbers, they may get emails, they may visit websites, they may even visit real-world locations in order to interact with this game and learn more about the story. Do you want to jump into the...
Hotel the Dark Knight?
Yeah.
One example of that was with the Dark Knight ARG, the movie The Dark Knight that just came out recently. And one of the things that they did to promote that ahead of time in the ARG was have a website that posted addresses. There were 12 different addresses kind of scattered all over the country. And the first person, you know, people who were, you know, in ahead of time and kind of watching for this, the addresses weren't up for very long. They were posted and then they went away. And on a certain date, you went to this address, and if you were the first person to get there, you went in and you found out that you were at a bakery, and you went in. The message, I think, that was also on the website. You went into the bakery and asked for a package for Robin Banks, and they give you this package, and it's a cake, and the cake has a number in icing on the top of it. And you call the number, and the cake starts ringing. And it's a cell phone that's inside the cake. And if you answer it, then it's the Joker calling, recruiting you basically to his pool of henchmen. And you know, the game kind of went on from there, where there were, you know, various ways that you could interact until the movie actually launched.
There's a same company, 42 Entertainment, is actually involved in a lot of these the recent ARGs. They also did one for Nine Inch Nails' album Year Zero. In addition to a lot of the regular tactics that ARGs have started using, they were leaving zip drives with unreleased MP3s of Nine Inch Nails songs in the bathrooms at concerts, which had hidden messages on them. And so, for example, one of them ended in cricket sound, and if the cricket sound was put through spectrographic analysis, you could find a phone number buried in it. And then calling the phone number led to the next clue, and so on. The culmination of the story arc ended up with about 50 fans that had figured out all the puzzles, going to a specific location, getting on a bus with a black van, with blacked out windows, ending up at a shady warehouse with armed guards patrolling the top, led through various mazes where they were given a surprise Nine Inch Nails concert, which only got through about four songs before being broken up by the SWAT team, after which they had to flee the building and get back on the bus. So you can see that these people who probably just started by visiting a website ending up having this very interactive, very visceral experience as a result of playing and engaging with story online.
We tried to pick, when we were coming up with this, there obviously several examples, again, that we're not covering, but we tried to pick a selection of each that were showing the range of what people were trying to do, all of, you know, different types of approaches to how do we tell stories as we move forward with integrating with our new technologies. One of the most recent ones was Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that one, but awesome. So this was basically collaboratively written by Joss Whedon and his friends and family while the writer's strike was going on. And it's three episodes of about 12 minutes each that tell the story of the mad scientist, you know, the evil mad scientist as the protagonist, and his antagonist is the, you know, the bold muscular hero. And there's definitely, you know, a girl in the story as well as the love interest. And it takes a very traditional model of storytelling and kind of turns it on its ear just a little bit in delightfully quirky ways. One of the other things that it does is it's one of the first ones that I know of that's a commercially viable online musical, because it really is a musical. It's very much they break into song and go dancing about and all that fun stuff as well. But they had a really interesting approach to it. They released it as a streaming video for free over the course of a week, but also simultaneously offered it as for sale on iTunes for not very much money. And it became, during that week, it became one of the top sellers on iTunes, even though it was also available for free. And then they also one of the other interesting approaches that they did in terms of blending business models is a lot of the merchandise that's available for Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog is in Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, the musical, you know, the video. There's a couple of scenes with fans of Captain Hammer, and they're wearing Captain Hammer t-shirts, which you can get from the Dr. Horrible store, and things like that. So you can buy the soundtrack, you can, there's all these different things that you can buy, most of which were integrated at some point into the project. Do you want to talk about Shadow Unit, or you want me to? I can do it. And then also another example that kind of leads into the next topic is Shadow Unit. I don't know if anybody's encountered that one. But this was it's described by the creators as writing fanfic for a TV show that doesn't exist. So it's basically it's designed around the TV episode format. And they had, you know, their first season end just recently, and they had several stories, novellas, short stories, and ended in an actual novel that was released sort of in real time. And it's a collaborative effort of professional writers doing this for free because they just got really geeked on the project. I think it's Emma Bull, Will Shetterly, Elizabeth Baer, Amanda Downham,
Sarah Manette.
And Sarah Manette, yeah, are all working together on this. And they had, one of the things that was interesting about Shadow Unit is they have incorporated a little bit of the ARG mentality, the alternate reality gaming mentality, blurring the line between fiction and reality a little bit, because several of the main characters in the Shadow Unit storyline have live journals and are blogging in their live journals just about their everyday lives, not about the story, just about, you know, what they're doing that day. And the fans can interact in comments and in dialogue with the character. They actually took this so far to one of the characters having an actual real-life girlfriend. She's the girlfriend of somebody who doesn't exist. She's a very interesting person, Tex Ann, if you ever encounter her online. She's pretty awesome. But the characters have live journals. The website has Easter eggs, so you can go to the website and just see the basic information. But if you know anything at all about how to find Easter eggs, you can find, you know, at least over the course of the season, you could find hidden things that they had added, little DVD extras, various, there was a shooting script from the TV show with like all these scribbled actor notes on it that was photocopied in and put up as one of the little extras at some point. So they really got very creative with how they approached it. And that one was also very interesting in that it had a lot of several inner circle fans that got into it very intensely, very quickly. And so they have kind of a fan-created, you know, fandom community that they gave themselves names, and they, you know, or their mission is basically to spread the story about Shadow Unit to as many people as possible and date characters and all the fun stuff like that. That one's a really good one to get into because it's now, they left it all up online, so you can go back and, you can't obviously get the real-time effect of interacting with the characters or the final novel being released in real time. It's like the events that were happening on Tuesday were happening on Tuesday of that day, which was very clever as well. But their second season is supposed to start in early 2009, and they do have 5 seasons planned at this point. So that's another interesting storytelling, 21st century storytelling approach that you can follow. So efforts like, you know, Shadow Unit and a lot of the other ones we mentioned, again, what we found over and over again was primarily people seem to be using mostly donation and merchandise-based profit models. How do you pay for a full-time job for 5 people writing on a project with donations and CD sales? You can't really in most circumstances. So that's one of the questions that we had, you know, that we came up with very quickly, you know, and in thinking about this, the question on everybody's lips is some form of show me the money, you know, how do I make money at this? How is this going to work for me? And when we went to a professional fantasy convention this year, 4th Street Fantasy Convention in Minneapolis, one of the things that surprised us just a little is that we found that the industry professionals there are pretty much asking the same questions. You know, even the professional editors and writers that have been doing this for a really long time, they recognize that the standard traditional publishing model has got limitations that aren't necessarily going to take us very far into the 21st century. But they don't have any more of an answer than we did about what that's going to look like, which was pretty exciting for us, because that means that if they don't know and we don't know, then anybody's up for grabs in terms of who gets to shape it and explore it and discover it.
Go ahead and put the next slide up.
So we started trying to explore and answer the business model question. We talked to writers, artists, artisans, ARG experts, you know, and even business consultants about, you know, their ideas, their concerns, all of the stuff that we gathered together in research. One of the pieces of feedback that we got was that there's really not very many people who have consulted professional business consultants on a project like this, on a creative project like this. It very much tends to be the model where you have a really cool idea, you have to invent this way of telling this story or you know, presenting this really cool idea. Halfway into it, you figure out that you're doing something new and there's no real support network for how to do it, and now what do you do? And you don't really have a lot of solid foundation to go on at that point. So one of the things that we found out that was different was one of the different approaches is looking at the business model during the creation stages of the project, not in the putting out fire stage of the project. Go ahead.
A lot of artists and creative types really shy away from this kind of thing, mm-hmm. and it's one of the things that we're trying not to do in creating anything that we're making. Unfortunately, right now, if you're going to explore new forms and you want that to continue, you often have to look to how am I going to make money from doing this. Otherwise, you end up with, looking at a day job in order to support your neat new online idea instead of your neat new online idea finding a way to actually make you money.
And so one of the business consultants that we talked to has Six Sigma certification, and a lot of the basic techniques that he uses to assess things in the business world were able to be applied to looking at our project. So when you're trying to set out on something like this and create something big and cool, the 5 W's and DMAC are basically the two tools that he used to assess our project. The 5 W's being ask yourself, what is it? Why should I want it? What's in it for me? What's it going to cost me, and where can I get it? And answering those 5 questions are very much key to having something, a solid business model that you can then launch from. The DMAIC, D-M-A-I-C, being define, measure, analyze, improve, and control. Control being sustain, be able to repeat your success. And he said basically the key things to remember when you're trying to do something like this is prioritize your steps, make a plan that allows flexibility when needed, and set yourself reasonable and achievable deadlines. Too many people have this really great idea and they try to do all of it at once. And a lot of these things, especially these large projects that involve interacting with multiple creative people, are not something that you can do all at once or even in a few weeks. And so answering the questions of the business model involves changing your idea of how a story is developed. I think it's your turn.
Okay. So, you know, as we described, we spent 9 months, you know, coming out, kicking this around, finding all these different ideas, researching it, and obviously, you know, what better way to test all these theories about storytelling and how it's changing than to try a project of our own? Obviously, it wasn't start quite that simple, but it's inevitable that as we explore these new models, we wanted to see how we could take them and how far we could push them. And we wanted to make sure that whatever project that we created would incorporate not just, you know, the themes of science fiction and fantasy, because that's what we do, but also to incorporate the ethics and storytelling paradigms that are beginning to be uncovered on the internet, such as, you know, giving it away but finding ways to make money from it anyway, and sharing content to create more expansive worlds, you know, that involve both the fans and the creators. Next slide, please. So what we ended up with was the Continuous Coast project. And the early stages of this, we discussed basically all the stuff that we've just been explaining to you with our housemate, the novelist Stephen Brust. And we, like I said, spent 9 months sort of cogitating and realized we ended up with a much more expansive project than just the three of us could handle. So we ended up recruiting a lot of writers, artists, artisans, computer geeks, and numerous other creative types to develop the project with us. What we've ended up with is a project we're calling Continuous Coast, which we're going to begin launching over the next several weeks. The Continuous Coast is an open content shared world. So we're taking a page from the old, you know, shared worlds such as Thieves World, Leavesque, and Border Town, except that this will be fully open content. The setting itself, the stories written about it, and most products created within it will be released under the Creative Commons Sharealike license, meaning that not only can you share it freely, you can make derivative works freely and make commercially viable derivative works. And it's also, of course, somewhat viral in the sense that you have to share what you create, regardless of whether or not you make money from it.
One of the things that we expect to be mildly controversial if we get any level of success with this project at all is, if you look at it a certain way, what Kit just described essentially legitimizes fanfic, which has been a very big sore point, you know, that we mentioned earlier for a lot of authors. Instead of trying to say, no, you can't do that, no, you can't create in our world, we're saying, no, here, anybody can, and here's how you do it. That's something that's a little bit different than what a lot of people are doing right now. And I guess touch on your stuff
again. So, you know, again, another one of the ethics we're working with is the idea of giving it away and that they'll pay you for it. You know, we're going to be releasing the setting itself in a, you know, online document that we're going to call the Loose Canon, which will be describing all the details of this fantasy world we've created. We even want to, you know, essentially make our fans into citizens of this world, involving them directly by having them create their own characters in the world. Obviously, there's nothing to stop them at that point from creating their own fiction, their own art, or other things in the world. And since we're going to do something that we're going to be dealing with for a long time that might end up taking over our lives, as so many of these other projects have that we mentioned earlier, we decided we really wanted to create a world that we wanted to live in ourselves, but still that gave us possibility for story. It's essentially a post-scarcity fantasy world, which we created somewhat post-scarcity, in which we removed a lot of the challenges of things like starvation and subsistence, but very carefully did not make it a utopia. There's still a lot of ways that people's lives get shortened much too quickly, and a lot of conflict in it. But we did take out some of the other conflicts that we were not necessarily thought were bad. There's a lot of authors that have dealt with, for instance, issues of race or being a member of an alternative sexual relationship, and they've dealt with that very effectively. So we wanted to see what kind of stories can we tell in a world where that kind of stuff's just plain accepted, and there's, you know, those aren't the basis of stories. No one gets kicked out of town because they sleep with another guy. They can get kicked out of town because of some other reason, but that's not one of them. So we decided to take certain things off the table and introduce other things, such as universal birth control, easily available for any gender, and see what kind of thing that would do for sexuality and what sort of stories we could tell about sex in a world where there weren't actually, you know, unplanned children.
And other things like that. Yeah, that's one of the stories that informed a lot of the early parts of the process that you can go read, and or also read the wiki summation of it, is by Jorge Luis Borges. It's Tlon Ukbar Telus Tertius, T-L-O-N, comma, U-Q-B-A-R, comma, Telus, T-E-L-L-U-S, Tertius, T-E-R-T-I-U-S. And that was very much an ahead of its time short story describing an author that finds a mention in an encyclopedia of a place that doesn't exist and starts researching that and starts finding out other intersections of this place that shouldn't exist in our world, and, you know, eventually, you know, starts trying to get his friends in on it and get him, get them to help out, and they all start creating it. And by working on this to try to find it, they essentially open the door for our world to start becoming Tellus Tertius. So it's a very interesting story, and if you read it through, then you can kind of see a little bit of some of what we imagine that this project is doing. Certainly from some of the early effects that we've gotten from different people we've approached on it, very much seems one of the most appealing aspects seems to be the multimedia aspect of the project. It's not just writers writing stories, it's, you know, people creating ceramic art and costumes and visual art and all sorts of different ways, pretty much any way that you think you can fit into it and express your creativity, we're open to at least hearing about. In addition to, you know, fan interactivity and creating characters, we also have, you know, people creating real-world artifacts that are essentially imports from the world that we've created. And there's a lot of opportunity for, again, who's a fan and who's a creator, and how much of each are you? And that line being blurred is also something else that we kind of see going into the 21st century changing a little bit. So to kind of sum up, a lot of our conclusions involve, you know, the question that we asked at the beginning, what is the 21st century novel? In seeking out how to answer that, we essentially found out that the 21st century novel is more 21st century storytelling. It's not really a novel, it's a new form. And the novel isn't necessarily going to die because a different form of storytelling exists, but it will certainly has the chance to change. One of the things that we think might easily happen is the novel becomes part of this whole setup where it's just one piece of merchandise for your interactive world.
There's a, when we were on the at 4th Street Fantasy Convention, we were actually asked to be on a panel called Advice from New Writers. And one of the things that we said that seemed to upset the established writers so much is, I don't think that going into the next, into this century, that we can really accept anymore the sort of stereotype of the science fiction writer as the, you know, guy with the typewriter who can't program his VCR. I think that essentially technology is going to be part of the 21st century storytelling process, whether it's in how you share the stories or what you do with them. They're essentially multidisciplinary, multimedia, and multi-genre.
And now we have time for questions.
One last slide, actually, here.
Oh, okay.
We wanted to actually give people stuff that they can, you know, actually take from our project or what we're doing. This presentation was meant to be a lot more interesting looking to watch, so we're hoping to have that October 1st business model PowerPoint, which is an overview of what business model we're using for our project, and also a paper on October 9th, which will go over all the different business models we uncovered on our research.
And the information that we learned from talking to our business consultants.
And those, there was supposed to be a URL up there, unfortunately it's not, are going to be on continuouslabs.com. And we're also going to have content on portoutreach.com, which is the first in-world fictional outcropping of the Continuous Coast. It's going to be a tourism bureau for one of our major metropolises in the world, including blogs from people that live there. So check that out as well on October 9th.
And one of the biggest things that we hope to see happen is people take all of those ideas and run with it and do their own thing and, you know, let us know about it, because, I mean, we'll probably eventually have, you know, version 2.0 of the business model paper, and it would be really useful to have a lot of real-world, up-to-date information done by people who actually tried it.
Thanks, Kit and Risa. We have time for one or two questions from the audience, and then we're... In the meantime, Daniel, you can try to set up the next presentation. Okay, one or two questions?
So when you guys set out to create kind of a community-based storytelling situation, what do you think that does to the aesthetic of the larger story? And what do you think, like, kind of a, I don't want to say homogenized, but if everybody's working on the same thing, you know, what's the end result? And what do you think that implies for the more traditional novel form?
The first word that jumped out at me from what you said asked is was homogenized.
Not in a bad way.
No, but I think that... it's kind of two-sided. One is that we've tried to create a very expansive world so that everyone can have their own threads going in it. But I think ideally, one of the things I've noticed in talking to people is that a lot of them are interested in creating something, but they've got ideas for stories. They read a story, they watch Star Trek, and they think, wow, that's really cool, but what if this happened? And I think a lot of them would like a place where they're actually invited, given permission to create in it. And I think what that does to the aesthetic of story is, I think it takes it out of the hand of sort of the ivory tower of authors to some extent.
Okay. Also, to kind of add to what I think you might have been asking, for us, it's very much interconnected. So the fact that we were setting out to do a collaborative storytelling project and approach it in that sense did very much affect the creation of the world. And so a lot of the themes that went into the creation of the world mirrored back that goal of creating this collaborative storytelling project. So not only are the authors and the creators involved in collaboration, but the people that inhabit the world, that ended up being very much a strong focus of their lives and their stories.
And they also give away a lot of content in their world. They create things that they give away to other citizens of their world. So we've very much found that the way we create the story has shaped the stories that we want to tell in it.
Did that mostly cover it? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm an old media book publisher, and I'd like to hear your ideal scenario for like this Harry Potter encyclopedia dictionary problem. I mean, what's the ideal outcome?
I guess for me personally, I don't see where.
Do you want to give an overview briefly of what happened?
I really don't have all the details.
Basically, there was a fan site, for people that aren't familiar with this, there was a fan site where there's a Harry Potter encyclopedia, which was initially given a nod of sort of being okay by J.K. Rowling, but then when they decided to publish a book version of it, she decided that she was going to sue, that it was infringement of her copyright, as well as her plans to make her own encyclopedia later.
Which, I guess that premise is one of the main ones that I disagree with. I don't necessarily, I mean, if there's a fan out there, like a serious fan of J.K. Rowling and her series, and they have, you know, this encyclopedia that was created by a fan, and I'm sure is decent enough for what it is. And then a year or two later, J.K. Rowling comes out with her encyclopedia, they're still going to run like droves to go get the official encyclopedia done by the actual author. So I don't necessarily see where it really impacted her profit margin in terms of, like, what exactly is the angle that you're asking in terms of from the publishing angle, what are you concerned about as we go into the 21st century?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm trying to read.
I thought I was watching TV.
No, sorry. I'm actually asking.
I'm just kidding. Well, for one thing, I just thought you would say something like, well, why doesn't this author just put the whole thing for free on the web?
Not necessarily, no. Just because we think that giving stories and giving content away for free is a good idea and a draw and a selling point doesn't necessarily mean that everything that we do in this project is going to be for free. You know, we're exploring a lot of different ways of what's that perfect mix between, you know, giving people the experience that they feel satisfied with and also encouraging them to want to spend their money in ways that keep me being able to do this from day to day, you know, keep food on my plate enough so I can do it.
Just because there are new models doesn't mean that we hate the old models. The old models are definitely still working for a lot of people. We mentioned Stephen Bruce, who we live with. He's, you know, a New York Times best-selling author, if you look at the extended lists, at least for his last book. That's obviously success through the old publishing model. The question is, you know, how much longer can that be sustained in the era of people giving away free fiction? People are always going to want books, but for those of us that are new to the field, there's often other ways, you know, maybe to approach this, to approach sharing story that aren't part of the old model.
One of the things that also might address your question to some degree is one of the things that Nine Inch Nails did when they got released, when Trent Reznor got released from his music contract. He's, over the past year or two that he's been released from that, has put tons of creative stuff up. And one of the first approaches was very much kind of a tiered effect, and that's one of the things that seems to be very viable, especially working with some more traditional models, is you have the online version that's just, text only, and that's free. And then if you want to pay $5 or $10, you can have the, the CD with a, liner notes. And then if you want to pay $75, you can have the vinyl set that you can mix with. And if you want to pay $250, you can have DVD extras, vinyl set, CD, signed poster, extra special track that nobody else gets. So at that point, you allow your customers to decide, how they're going to interact with it. And every single one of those levels, except I just want this text-only story for free, is making some kind of money. And yeah, there's going to be people that just want the text-only story for free, but there's going to be a lot of people that, I want to see that cover art. I want to, hear the DVD extras. I want to know the behind-the-scenes commentary. So I would be a customer that would very much be willing to pay for that extra content.
Do you envision a price tier where I get a license for derivative works?
I'm sorry, can you
say that again?
Do you envision a price tier where I get a license for derivative works?
You'd like to make your own content in the world? No, because the Creative Commons share alike license explicitly allows you to take it and use it. We're obviously going to for our project, yeah. I mean, if you're asking about our project specifically, we're going to give the world away, essentially, the setting for free so that anybody can pick up and use it. We might do some licensing of, if you want to have our trademarked logo on your project, possibly we might do licensing for that kind of thing. But in general, as far as being able to make something set in Continuous Coast or art from there, no, there's not really going to be a licensing fee for that.
But I think that to take it away from our project, to answer your question in a more general sense, that yes, that is one model that seems to be viable based on our research is the concept of, the basic story or the basic product being available for free, but then you have memberships that you can buy that allow you access to that, special premium content. And that does seem to be something that's working in at least several different situations so far.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Risa and Kit.